Gentlemen, our first case for argument, Schmidt versus Eagle Waste, Mr. Gold.
If it may please the court. My name is Samuel Gold. I am representing the appellant, Tammy Schmidt, in this Fair Labor Standards Act case. Our case was dismissed on summary judgment. Read the briefs. Although we cited by pinpoint citation, citations to the record, which we believe created genuine issues of material fact, the court did not consider any of our facts because we did not format them or lay them out correctly for the court. For that, I'm very contrite, and at the time, I was very contrite and moved for leave to...
Well, why didn't you comply with the rule?
It was an inadvertent oversight, a misstep on my part. I don't make any excuse for it. Once brought to my attention, I brought it to the court's attention in hopes that the court would consider the information. In the motion that I filed for leave to correct the brief, I made it very clear that I wasn't going to insert any new facts or try to sneak anything new in. I did not want to prejudice or unduly prejudice the defendant in any way, shape, or form. Instead, we got the decision, as you know, and I think you've read it, and I won't go through it. We were also surprised, actually much to our prejudice, when the defendant claimed in some fashion at the end of the summary judgment process that the plaintiff was an exempt administrative employee. Now, I've read the case law, and sometimes it wasn't there as an affirmative defense. It wasn't raised either in the pretrial report as an issue. But we also propounded a specific request for admission, where we asked whether or not the defendant was claiming the plaintiff was an administrator for purposes of the FLSA. In its briefs, quite incredulously,
you listed, you have a statement of facts, which I take it is based in your opening brief. I take that's based on what you'd submitted in the district court. The district court didn't allow.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then the defendant has a statement of facts, presumably based on, you know, his summary judgment facts. In your reply brief, you don't indicate which of his facts you disagree with.
Well,
so you're still not presenting the, you know, you're not, still not presenting your case in a way that the court can understand what it is. That is, you've repeated what you did in the district court. You have not actually contested the factual assertions of the defendant.
Yeah. In our initial brief, those were largely a recitation of what we'd put in our summary judgment brief. And I believe that a reading of those facts...
But we still don't know where you actually disagree with the defendant's facts. For example, the defendant says that she was and wanted to be called and was called an account representative. Well, you didn't say in your reply brief whether that's correct or incorrect. She's an account representative. Hard to see her as an hourly worker.
I think we acknowledge that she was an account representative, but it's not dispositive under the FLSA. Job titles are not dispositive. The courts usually look, Your Honor, at to what the actual duties were, and I think that all of our pinpoint citations are replete with allegations.
But they say, for example, that, you know, every morning on her way to work, she stops at three potential customers and so on. You say in your reply brief that that's false. So are we supposed to take that as true or what?
Supposed to even, do with that? Even if you took it as true?
Well, should we take it as true or what?
Yes. If I didn't dispute it, you should take it as true.
Well, you didn't dispute anything in your reply brief.
The reply brief did not add anything to our initial brief in terms of disputing the facts. We were just asking that the initial facts, which we had cited to the record, raise
but
enough.
But we'd like to know whether there's any actual disagreement over the facts.
I think there's big disagreement.
Well, apparently not about the account representative, not about the 3 hour or the three stops on the way to work.
Even if those were true, that wouldn't be dispositive in the case. When you read all of the other disputed facts that we've laid out, none of that would be dispositive because it's really a large hurdle in a statute like the FLSA for the defendant to make their case than other cases because of the humanitarian nature of the statute. Yes?
Let me ask this. Is it true that your client spent a minimum of 4 hours a day and sometimes as many as 8 hours a day outside the office making sales calls?
Sometimes, yes.
So
between 20 and 40 hours a week, she's outside the office. Making independent or outside sales calls, why isn't that dispositive if there's no dispute? Regardless of the rest of the factual disputes.
Our citation is that, according to her direct supervisor, Mr. Albee, is that she was in the office more than 50% of the time.
You've just told me that she spent at least half of her time and sometimes all of her time outside the office.
Well, you know, we're seeing disputes between even her supervisor not knowing what she's doing and...
Well, this is where Judge Posner's line of questioning is critical because if you don't dispute that, I mean, if she acknowledges and it's undisputed that she spends at least 4 hours a day and sometimes as many as 8 hours a day outside the office making sales calls, then that's dispositive.
Well, you'd have to determine whether or not it was every single day. There is testimony from that we've cited in the record from her supervisor that she never was really out of the office more than two consecutive days a week. So just some, even
that's 40% of a week. It's an awful lot. For an hourly worker?
I think that's one element, Your Honor, of many that needs to be considered, and all of the elements, the case as a whole, was not considered, and that is the crux of our argument. That's the crux of our, it continued to be the crux of our reply brief. And I understand what we have here, essentially. And I see my white light is on. I understand here that there's a conflict.
Mr. Gold, what are the two strongest factors or facts that speak to your position that would tilt the balance in your favor?
That none of our facts were considered, and therefore...
What are those facts that you suggest, if brought to the court's attention, would put the thumb on the scale on your side?
During the first months of defendant's tenure, only 3% of Ms. Schmidt's time was devoted to sales, as she described it, not even an hour a day. For time, the defendant operated out of apartment. Ms. Schmidt moved furniture, helped set up a workplace, create forms, routine data entry, set up office equipment.
Yeah, but then her, yeah, no, but her job morphed into making sales, right? A third of her job, her salary comes from commissions and in-person calls, right? I mean, most of the time.
I know it's a third in commissions, but the majority is in salary.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. But her contact with the public that she's trying to gain business from is clearly outside, right? I mean, she goes outside to meet these people. I understand there are phone calls, but...
She did go outside to meet people.
I mean, she's not somebody in an appliance store on the floor selling washer dryers, right?
No. She also...
I mean, who could be a commission person, obviously, also.
Correct. I mean, she also did troubleshooting for the mechanics with the truck breakdowns. There's no records.
Oh, I understand it's a mix. It's a mix, right? She does some inside work.
There's a mix. There's a mix, and when there's a mix, I think the court in this situation, you've got two strong public policies hitting each other, and I just want to touch on those.
Your time has expired.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Trottier.
My name is Jeff Trottier. I'm with the law firm of Davis & Keel. We represent the defendant, Appellee, Eagle Waste and Recycling. Basically, we're here because plaintiff has left this trail of errors in opposition to summary judgment and is here asking that you excuse her errors. She's made four grave errors. We already discussed that she failed to dispute Eagle's proposed findings of fact, leaving them undisputed. She has failed to file her own proposed findings of fact. She waited 14 days after realizing that to actually request a reply. Three huge mistakes. The district court acted within its discretion to then find Eagle's proposed findings of fact undisputed. The fourth mistake is also another large mistake. She built her case on the 1993 FLSA regulations, which were superseded by the 2003 regulations, meaning that the standard for the primary duties should be limited not from the 80% found in the FLSA regs at 1993, but to the 50%. So we just had to show that she spent 50% of her time engaged in outside sales. Regardless of all these mistakes, this is really just a run-of-the-mill overtime claim. And the undisputed facts show that she spent 50% of her time outside of the office, making outside sales, exercising independent judgment and discretion, deciding who to address, who to try and sell these services too. She spent her time collecting so that she could increase her commissions. She spent her time engaged in activities which helped her increase her sales, therefore increase her commissions. Our argument can pretty much be summarized as follows, that this court should affirm the district court's enforcement of their local rule, finding that Eagle's proposed findings of fact were indeed undisputed, and then applying the 2003 FLSA regs to those proposed findings of fact or undisputed facts, finding her to be an outside salesperson because she spent 50% of her time on outside sales or activities to help her increase her sales. And if the court then affirms this decision, it can go on and affirm summary judgment on that basis and does not even need to consider whether Eagle gave plaintiff adequate notice of the administrative exemption, the combination exemption, or whether they should have been offered the opportunity to file a surreply brief. Because the only issue to consider on surreply, once the rest of this is disposed of, would be whether or not we argued the proper sham affidavit argument or standard. And the sham affidavit argument wasn't even addressed by the district court. So it's not actually a proper issue for appeal. Based on that, I guess there are 5 points I'd like the court to consider. First, that the district court acted properly and within its discretion in accepting Eagle's proposed findings of fact as undisputed based on local rule. Second, that the district court properly found plaintiff was an exempt outside salesperson by applying the 50% primary duties test and also finding that she exercised independent judgment and discretion. Third, the plaintiff received adequate notice that Eagle would plead the outside sales exemption, an exemption which they do not object to either on summary judgment or on appeal. That plaintiff received adequate notice that Eagle would plead also the administrative exemption, and the combination exemption. Fourth, that the district court properly refused to allow the plaintiff.
Well, I don't think you gave them notice that you were going to argue the administrator exemption. Your argument that you thought they were asserting that the plaintiff was the wage and hour administrator, that's preposterous.
Okay.
How could you think that?
Sorry?
How could you think that?
Based on the wording of their request for admission, was she an administrator?
You thought the wage and hour administrator was suing you?
No, we did not, which is why we denied. Also because even if we were to take that out of the definition found in the FLSA regs and look more colloquially, I'm sorry, and think, was she an administrator? When personally I think of administrator, I think of a more high-level person such as a CFO, a COO, someone who would actually fall under the executive exemption, not the administrative exemption. So we did indeed feel that we properly denied that. But regardless of that issue, we also did properly raise that issue in summary judgment in our initial brief. In plaintiff appellant's briefs, she claims that we only raised that in our reply brief. That is patently untrue. We did address the administrative exemption and the combination exemption fully in our initial summary judgment brief. And looking at Seventh Circuit precedent, it seems evident that that is also adequate notice because plaintiff then has the opportunity to respond in the response brief. Also, discovery in this case was directed towards job duties and how those job duties were allocated, how much time was spent. That indicates both the outside sales exemption and the administrative exemption. And also, whenever you have two exemptions under the FLSA that you're examining, the combination exemption also automatically comes into play. Just a review of the FLSA regs could have indicated that we were also looking at the administrative exemption. We would also argue that the district court properly refused to allow plaintiff to file us a reply. I believe I discussed that at that point the only issue to discuss on surreply based on the motion filed by plaintiff would be the sham affidavit argument not addressed by the district court. Finally, that a liberal construction of the FLSA does not supplant the plain language of either the statute or the regulations promulgated by the Department of Labor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Trottier. Thank you. Finished? Are you finished?
I believe so.
Okay, thank you. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just thought you would finish. Okay, Mr. Gold, your time expired. We'll give you another minute if you'd like. Anything further?
Thank you, sir. Your Honor. I just wanted to close by saying that there are two public policies that clash here. One is the deference given to local district courts and how they run their courtrooms and their summary judgment procedure. The other is the long ingrained policy in the Seventh Circuit as well as in the U.S. Supreme Court that cases ought to be resolved on their merits and not on procedural matters. And especially in a humanitarian statute such as the FLSA, there should even be given more deference in that matter. And I believe that if this court did look at our pinpoint citations, it would find that there are genuine issues of material fact. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Gold and Mr. Trottier. Our next case.